Spark, stories from advocates for global change, a podcast from the Swiss Young Academy.
Welcome to today's episode of Spark. My name is Julia and next to me is Zora.
Hi.
Today we are listening to the last interview of this series on the influence of social media on democracy. For this, you traveled to Geneva, Zora, right?
Yes, I met Tommaso Venturini at the University of Geneva. He works there as an associate professor at the Media Lab. In the past, he has also worked as a researcher at the Center for Internet and Society in France. I've talked with him about how conspiracy theories spread across internet subcultures and how social media platforms should be more transparent about what information they show. Let's dive into our conversation.
Rustle the paper. Okay, perfect. Let's start. What is your background and what motivated you to work at the intersection of new media and society?
I've been trained as social scientist from the start in a very kind of interdisciplinary background because I did my master and bachelor at the University of Bologna in the communication program of Umberto Eco, which was really at the crossroad between a lot of things, semiotics, media studies, sociology, anthropology, and many other disciplines. And from there on, I was always very much interested in the effect that digitalization and digital technology had on the way in which communicate with each other and, you know, in terms of the effect that has on the political organization that we can express as a society.
How has your work in this field changed the way you view technology and media?
I think that when I began working on this topic, I mean, still, or even like studying this topic as an undergrad and student at University of Bologna, it was the time where the internet was just beginning to become a mainstream popper thing. So it was a moment of great expectation and great hopes, particularly of the democratic potential and the way it would maybe make human communication more horizontal and more open to everyone. And then, of course, you know, even reminding that today seems a bit naive because we know that not all these hopes and promises have been fulfilled. And, you know, quite the contrary, there's nowadays a lot of concern about the democratic and political effect of new media, which I think, you know, it's maybe a little bit overblown as well. So I've been on a sort of like swinging pendulum from like being, you know, very enthusiastic and hopeful about this, and then with many other people becoming more critical and pessimist. And now we're maybe are overriding a bit too quickly some of the good and interesting things that can come from this media.
So you used to work as a researcher at the Center for Internet and Society. Now you work at the Media Lab. I think both of these institutions work for an interdisciplinary approach to study the intersection of politics, society, and the digital world. Can you tell us, about projects you used to do back at the Center for Internet and Society, and maybe tell us the connection to your current work?
One of the reasons why I've always liked working with digital technologies and digital media is that it's a relatively new field. So the kind of disciplinary constraints that the research should face in other sub-discipline or sub-fields of research are less strong here. So I think we have more freedom, if you want, to innovate, to be imaginative, to try out new stuff. And my research currently is focused on two main things. One is methods. So I've been working my whole career around digital methods and how we can use the arrival of new technology in order to kind of liberate the methodological imagination of sociologists and make it, you know, larger, wider, and capable to try new things through these new technologies. And also I'm more and more interested and kind of obsessed about internet subcultures. So all the kind of the weird things that people do on their internet, maybe not on the main, most visible platform, but at the margins of the internet. Some of this stuff, it's very toxic, not always very, I'd say, wholesome, but some of it is. And even when it's toxic, there is some creativity and imagination there that it's interesting, even though, as I said, you know, sometimes it's also a little bit hard to study these communities because they can be quite brutal in many ways and not exactly the thing, or actually the opposite of the kind of value that we would like to push.
Can you give us maybe an example of these subcultures that you study and how you think they will transform or how they have a transformative power in society?
Yeah, for example, I've been working with colleagues on discourses developing on 4chan, which is this very dark image board and forum online where a lot of like extreme right toxic ideas have come from. And I think for a long time, this kind of research was considered, quite fringe and marginal. We have seen more and more that a lot of these ideas actually then like trickles down to the mainstream of media and then to, you know, even the mainstream of society and have an important and quite bad, frankly, impact on our societies. So I think that it is important that we study this thing in the egg, basically, so that when they arrive in the center of the public scene, at least we know what we're talking about and how these things function.
Can you also give an example about the methods part of your work that you're studying?
Yeah, so in the social sciences, there is this like huge divide, very sort of steep between quantitative methods, people that do surveys and statistics, basically, and then qualitative methods, people that do interviews, focus group, ethnography, observation, these kind of techniques. And they do speak to each other, but they don't work together, right? And you can use mixed methods, which is using a little bit of both and combining them, but you're still remaining sort of within these boxes, which I think are convenient and useful in many cases, and we know well how they work, but they also constrain a lot what we can do. And so what I try to do with digital methods is to develop what I call quali-quantitative methods, which I think I should rather call like neither qualitative nor quantitative methods, or non-binary methods, I sometimes call them, which is the methods that do not resemble to either quantitative or qualitative methods, and which allows at the same time or in a few clicks to move from a very large overview of a lot of text or a lot of interactions or a lot of traces or different types to like zoom down or drill down to one specific data points that might be particularly interesting and like close read what it means and what it stands for.
So additionally, you are a founder of the Public Data Lab. What is the focus of this initiative?
Yeah, so the Public Data Lab pursue kind of similar ideas, but in the context of citizen engagement and sort of reaching out to actors that are beyond the academia. So this adjective public in the name is to work with activists, with decision makers at different like public and commercial organization, but also with just interest citizens and develop projects that are somewhere on the border of academia, I would say, that leverage the kind of research that we do with digital methods and with digital records in the social sciences, but to use them maybe in a more direct contact with the society or la cité, as they say here in the French Switzerland.
So I've shortly read about one of these projects called Citizen Facts. Can you shortly explain what this one is about?
Yeah, this is an ongoing project that is actually just begun, and it's a collaboration with a group of journalists and NGOs that's also called Citizen Fact. And what they do is that they organize journalistic inquiries using digital means and digital records in collaboration with newsroom of citizens. So it's not just the journalists doing their sort of data journalist work, but opening these data journalist projects to everyone who wants to contribute. And what I'm doing, what the Media Lab is doing in this project, is that we are helping them to sort of to reflect and document their practices to see what works, what doesn't work, and to maybe try, if we can, to write that up as clearly as possible so that other journalists or other news initiatives that would like to use a similar approach can maybe avoid some of the errors that have been made and learn from what have actually worked well in this existing project.
So why do you think it is so important to include citizens in this type of research?
I think it is important to include citizen in, I mean, it is important to open up academia to actors from outside the academia, which is not just citizen, but like any potential concern or interest social actors in research in order to make the dissemination of the results that we produce and the results themselves more relevant for society. In the case of my own research, which is itself centered on public debate and sort of the political effect of social media and digital media, that's even more important because, of course, like citizens are directly concerned by this thing. So it would be kind of weird not to involve them because they're actually the protagonist of this phenomenon. So we might as well, we have to include them.
What is the most challenging aspect of communicating and working with the public or also policymakers?
That's a good question. I think there's a lot of like what Marsha McLuhan called moral panic about the media, which means that every time that new medium appears, suddenly people freaks out and think it's going to be the end of the world, the end of society, and then it's going to waste the youth. Which is, of course, false. The world has not ended. Society has not ended. Young people are still alive and well. So one has to, at the same time, recognize the existence of real risks and threats in this technology, but without falling into the trap of overselling them, overhyping them, because that makes it more difficult to understand them and also have all sorts of side effects. For example, I've been working on like online disinformation for some time. And since I've started doing this kind of research, I've been constantly contacted by all sorts of policymakers at the national and international levels. And because they're like gripped in this sort of moral panic, they are in a sort of emergency mode in which if they could, and in some countries they can, they would go like very quickly to censoring everything or a lot of what is going online, which is not, of course, the good reaction that one should have, even if you acknowledge that online disinformation is a problem. So it's striking this difficult balance between, on the one hand, like reassuring society and policymaker and decision maker that maybe, you know, not everything is bad, things are not bad as they might look. But on the other hand, also like sort of acknowledging and specifying and making more precise the kind of fears or concerns that they have, because these problems do exist, but they're more complex, subtle, sophisticated that's often we think.
You mentioned the censoring. So just very recently, Australia passed one of the strictest laws for the usage of social media for young people. I think anyone under the age of 16 is banned from creating a social media account. What is your opinion on this law and this debate in general?
It is a very common reaction to believe that young people are victims of new media, right? So we have that for television, we had that for, even before that, we had that for radio, then for television, that for video games, you know, every new technology is supposed to victimize the youth, which is frankly not true, or not specifically true. So I don't think that young people are more vulnerable to the risk of digital media or social media than older people. We're all equally vulnerable. So I think that every solutions that targets or address specifically young people as if the exact same type of problem were not also concerning other generation or other social groups, I think it's not a great solution. That does not mean that we should not regulate social media. I think we should definitely regulate social media much more than what we do right now. But I don't think that it's, you know, that we should focus specifically on young people.
What kind of regulations are you thinking about? What kind of responsible regulations could be implemented?
Well, we certainly need much more transparency so that we could know what's going on in this media and in the sort of algorithmic and technological infrastructure that they have built. The European Union is actually going in that direction with the latest regulation. They do force, they have not been implemented yet, but there is this effort to force large platforms, large search engines to collaborate with scholars in the academia and researchers also outside the academia, so that we can at least look what's happening inside, because these are really big technological systems and it's very difficult to understand even like sort of what's popular, what's not, what people are viewing for how long, et cetera, et cetera. And so these data, they exist, platforms have them, but then don't share them because they kind of sell them for marketing purpose. It's the, you know, it's sort of the business model of surveillance capitalism, but it's not a model that is very compatible with, certainly not with academic research, but also not with policy that sort of understand what's going on and then make informed decision about how this can be regulated. So I think that first we need to know a little bit more to do more research on what's going on. And then from there, we would probably know and sort of put together better regulation about this media.
How do you think social media platforms influence democracy and the way we get our news?
Well, this is a very complicated question. So at a basic level, what has happened with the arrival of social media platform is that the barriers to communication have been drastically lowered. In a sort of a broadcast regime, which is the regime of radio and television and newspaper, there were only a limited amount of communication channels, the airwaves, the paper. And so these were very well guarded by a system of gatekeeping, as it's called, which was not necessarily perfect, not at all. It was actually denying voice to many people, and it was really enforcing some social asymmetries. And then what happened with the arrival of digital media, and in particular social media, is that everyone now can potentially, in the public space, which is, on the one hand, it's a good thing, but then the problem kind of moves from access to speaking to access to listening. So the problem is now, today, there are so many people publishing stuff online that is just impossible for anyone or even for everyone as a society to consume, to read all these things. And that is why then recommendation algorithm has become so important, right? Because we need technological tools to filter out a lot of the stuff that is published online. But then the same problem of gatekeeping appears for now, this recommendation algorithm. So how do they work? What do they push forward? What do they hide? Who do they empower and who they strip power away from? And so the kind of similar problem that were observed, you know, that always existed for broadcasting media are now coming back through social media, but also in slightly different ways.
So we already shortly touched on this. So you did research on conspiracy theories and internet subcultures. So what are your most interesting insights from this work?
Yeah, so the one idea that I'm kind of obsessing about in the last few years is this hypothesis that maybe digital cultures resemble more to oral culture, so to the culture of society before the introduction of literacy, before the introduction of the alphabet and the printing press. Because in this society, there were little or no mean to write down and to make permanent important pieces of culture. And so in this culture, one would have to constantly repeat over and over again the same ideas, notions, pieces of knowledge, so that they can be preserved and passed over from generation to generation. And to some extent, digital media resemble to that, not because they don't use writing, they do use writing a lot, but because they also tend to have a very short memory. Stuff disappear very quickly online, and even if it's archived somewhere, generally people do not dig it up, particularly in social media. So it's a very ephemeral environment in a way that resembles that of pre-literate society. And so I'm curious to know how these online cultures, and particularly I think it's particularly visible when studying conspiracy theories online, how these theories are, probably we should not call them theories either, right? Because theory is it's a word that is generally used for like scientific theory, which is very written in nature. They are based on writing. You know, cultural anthropology has shown that science is only possible where you have writing, because you can then write down your findings. And instead of that, what we have are conspiracy folklore, which is basically like folk tales that are repeated over and over again, and they change a little bit while being repeating and stuff like that. And so I think people talk a lot about like internet memes. You've probably heard about this expression, you know, it's the common expression. But what I don't like about it is that it connects internet cultures to this kind of a biological metaphor, like memes as genes, as replicator, biological replicator. I don't think that's a good metaphor to understand this. Instead, I think we should use metaphor coming from folklore study, from narratology, from, you know, the study of the lore of traditional societies. I think that's a much better metaphor to understand what's happening online today.
Maybe can you give us an example of maybe one of the wildest theories, or in your case, folklores you've come across on the internet?
Currently, I'm studying this, it's called the New World Order conspiracy theory. It's an old conspiracy theory that had been developed after the Second World War, during the Cold War. And it's this idea that international organizations have hatched a sort of master plan to control, you know, anyone, like to strip countries from their national sovereignty and also like citizen from their freedom and imposing them all sorts of rules and norms, which is, of course, you know, crazy, because we know that probably, especially when we look at problems such as climate change or environmental preservation, that quite the contrary, international organizations have very little leverage on national politics and even less of individual behavior. So this idea of like people being controlled by this international elite is just, you know, not true in the fact. But it's also, to some extent, a theory that resonates a lot, because it kind of, it reverses a lot of the communication and the marketing of some of these organizations. If you think about, for example, the World Economic Forum, because we're in Switzerland, you know, it's a lot of selling these like hyper-technological utopia where, you know, with sort of cryptocurrency and CRISP genetic technology and artificial intelligence and so on and so forth, all sort of combined together, we will sort of build this perfect future in which everything will be optimized. And this kind of conspiracy theory takes these stories, which are also kind of very sort of fanciful story, and reverse them into this dystopian version of them. So I'm interested in how there's this sort of narrative back and forth between the official narratives of international organizations and the readings and retelling that some of these online groups do of them.
Why do you think this theory like appeals so much to people when you're saying that like it doesn't seem like these international organizations have much leverage? How come that people are still so attracted to this type of theory?
Well, because if you understand this theory as folk tales, like as stories, credibility and adherence to facts is not what is the most important about a story, right? The same thing, and you know, and that is true for internet memes, but it's also true for a lot of online communication and online marketing in general, and advertisement. The point is not whether they are true or not, it's whether they are enjoyable, whether they are addictive, whether they can suscitate emotion and feelings. And I think they're very good in that. They can be easily debunked when you fact check them, but because they're perceived as stories and folk stories, people don't really do that.
So moving on to some questions about achievements and maybe impact of your work, can you share a story where your work made a significant impact on a policy or public awareness?
In this type of research, I think it's actually very, very difficult to have a direct impact, especially when you are a European researcher, because you know, many of these platforms and companies are actually based in other countries. I hope that if something has made an impact, is this work that I've been doing to try to shift attention away from fake news, which I think is a very bad label for online misinformation, to what I call junk news, to give this idea that maybe the problem is not that they're fake or truth or that that's not a good way of defining them, but this junkiness, this sort of being like a little bit like junk food for news, right? So you don't consume junk food because you think it's nutrients or even like it's good for your health. You clearly know that's not the case, but you still consume it because it's addictive. And I think a lot of these news we still consume, not because we know that they are false and that they are disinformation, but we still find them attractive and addictive. And I think that, you know, if, again, as I said before, if we start thinking this new way, we might be slightly more effective in fighting against them.
What has been the most rewarding aspect in your career, in your work so far?
Well, it definitely has been, I think it has been very much in teaching rather than in research, or the way in which research have nourished the way in which I've been teaching to students, for sure, like master students and undergrad students, but also very importantly, younger scholar, like PhD students and younger colleagues that I've been working with. I think that is super rewarding to maybe kind of build the little tiny brick conceptual tool or whatever that someone else can use to do something else. I think that's really rewarding.
What are the qualities and maybe passions most important for succeeding in this sector?
I think that research and academic careers demands being able to see things in different ways and be able to be a little bit original in your thinking. So that helps a lot. But it also has to be combined in a quite counterintuitive way with being quite painstaking and meticulous, and sort of always double check, triple check all the kind of things, because it's easy to make errors and mistakes, and that's the kind of thing that you really want to avoid. And then also, I'd say, but that's particularly true for the social sciences, and would not be true for other scientific careers, writing is very important. Like we spend most of our life as social scientists writing up stuff. So, I mean, if you have a writer block, and maybe, think a career in maybe another discipline.
I think we're going to come to a conclusion. So most of us interact daily with social media, me included. What advice do you have for personal detection of online misinformation and the responsible use of these platforms?
Well, I think, to put it easily, don't be lazy, right? There's a lot of interesting stuff online. If you take any platform, it's full of extremely interesting and thoughtful and rich and enriching content. Like, I don't know, if you go on YouTube or TikTok or whatever, you can find the worst, most superficial and sort of stupid and addictive video that will not really sort of nourish your life. But you can also find extremely interesting, well-thought productions that are really, frankly, they're not worse than the education you could get at the university, right? But they require an effort to find them, to listen through them, to maybe check for their sources. It's really a question of putting the effort needed to learn from it. There's a lot out there. But, if you just go for the easiest or the most entertaining, you'll probably miss on the most rewarding stuff.
So, Tommaso Venturini, thank you very much for the interesting insights.
Thank you.
So that was the interview with Tommaso Venturini. I really appreciate his advice on what we can actually do in our everyday lives so that we are aware of what type of information we actually consume. And I really liked his metaphor on the junk news that you know they are not really good for you, but is still sort of addictive. And so this pre-bunking and being media literate is really important. I was also glad to hear that it's not the young people who are just affected or more vulnerable towards social media, but really it's everyone who should be cautious and aware of what they consume.
Personally, I find it really interesting that social media can be this tool to give everyone a voice to speak in public. And yet, as Tommaso says, the problem kind of moves away from access to speaking to access to listening, since not everyone's voice is actually heard on social media. So this relates to how these algorithms work and how they favor certain content that is supposed to get more clicks. Here, I really agree with him when he asks for more transparency on how these algorithms actually work.
To wrap up these three episodes on social media and democracy, I find it very fascinating to see the diverse aspects and dimensions of mis- and disinformation. First, Anna Chauvin emphasized the fact that statements are often taken out of context to mean something completely different from what was initially intended. And this makes them difficult to detect. In particular, AI tools are not necessarily good at this. And this is exactly why we also need people like Sophie Timmerman, who put a great effort into fact-checking false information that is often spread by users thinking it's correct, especially in the case of breaking news.
Lastly, Tommaso Venturini's perspective reveals that in some cases it is not about whether these stories are true, but rather about how addictive and entertaining they are, just like folk tales. In my opinion, this means that the results from a fact-checking need to be made attractive themselves. Now, after talking about all these risks and challenges, let's not forget that there are also positive sides of social media. As Anna Jobin mentioned, there are communities on these platforms where people can be themselves and feel supported. And if you make an effort instead of just picking the first piece of content, there is a lot of high-quality productions on social media.
So with that, we come to the end of this series, and we are happy to hear your feedback on our podcast. You can find our address in the show notes, or you can directly comment on Spotify. If you enjoyed this podcast, you might also want to listen to our other two series on climate change and artificial intelligence.
And our next topic will be on human rights. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Spark. Stories from advocates for global change. A podcast from the Swiss Young Academy. Hosted by Julia Knuchel, Tanish Shingi and Zora Althaus. Produced by the Podcast Schmiede.